on Wolf Spirit Radio, No Borders Radio, and everbeyond.info. Be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond, 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 beyond.
Ah, salam alaikum. 11th of May 2014. Time whizzes by, it seems. Here we are. It's the middle of May now. It's unbelievable. Anyway, so tonight I have a very special returning guest. He's been on before. We've had a good old crack. We're from UK. We're in the kingdom, in the union. Oh, well, not really. We're on the islands. The union is just a construct, and we're in the parts of ancient Atlantis that they now call Greater Britain. And you're on the other side of a border of some. You know, it's like that. Borders does. It's just imaginary. You're certainly on the other side of the water there, and on the west coast. But I'm very, very pleased to have Thomas Sheridan on this evening. Good afternoon. Good evening, Thomas. It's afternoon in America, but it's evening here.
Hi, JP. Great to be back.
I just walked myself down a verbal cul-de-sac there. So,
correction, I'm not in the union.
You're not in the union, no.
I'm just over the border in the Republic,
that's
so.
That's right, we're in unity consciousness, though.
Yeah, exactly. The right kind of union.
So, you've just written a book. We've also, you know, between the last time we spoke and this time, we've uncovered a whole lot more about the control system with our own little bits and pieces. We'll go into that later. What I find was an interesting synchronicity is that I played randomly a show that I recorded last year with my co-host Katie Galanti, and we were talking, and she mentioned the title of your book, Valpurgis Night. So let's go there. It's a Finnish festival, like Beltane or something, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Nordic, but the Finnish were like very much into pushing it. In fact, it was actually kind of a Christian thing as well. But ultimately, it's about it's almost like, Beltane, as we know in the Celtic countries, is the veil between when the world's, you know, the festivals of fire. You know, that's a major festival at that time, at the beginning of spring. But Valpurgis Night, and Valpurgis actually takes in both Beltane and the day before April 30th. So it's April 30th, the night of April 30th at sundown until May 1st. It's all the same festival. Now, in the Nordic tradition, in the Celtic tradition, it's about the purification and the beginning of the year. So, like in Ireland and Scotland and the Celtic countries, the Gaelic countries, actually, they used to drive their cattle through fire. Not they wouldn't burn them, but through they were like flaming rows of fire, and then the people would follow, and the idea was that when you'd walk between these two columns of fire, you're purified and all the diseases of the winter were gone, and it was you were clean, and the cattle were clean, and the landscape was clean, and it was a beginning of a fresh new beginning. This would have been more akin to their new year. You know, well, it makes more sense that the new year actually happens now. The Finns and the Nordic people came with Valpurgis, which is the same, similar idea. Again, but there was a darkness to it. They brought in an element that the night before Beltane was the night of the last great darkness of the, you know, both in a metaphorical and a real sense, the final rite of the dark night of the soul. And in the Nordic sense, the witches would take flight. to see the Witch King or the Demon King in his mountains to get their orders for the year. And then they would spend in their, you know, in their things, terrorizing Christians for the rest of the year. But it goes back actually much deeper. It's really about the darkness before the storm in a psychic level. That's what those two holidays in that Nordic sense stand for. So it gets really bad the night before, and then it gets really good. Now, the idea for the book being called that was, I thought that was a phenomenal metaphor for, well, it's a bit of a long story. Do you want me to continue on talking about how it came about, the whole idea of this?
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah. we got plenty of time, so just go for it.
If I'm rambling, let me know.
But I'll just give you a quick prod, yeah. But it's a very relevant, because, you know, this is happening not only on a kind of ceremonial level, but it's happening within each and every one of us. Whether we know it or not, these things are happening in our lives, and by going through a ceremony, it gives a context to it. And I think this is the reason that we have all these cyclical ceremonies, because they give a context to the feelings that you're going through. But even if you're not going through the ceremonies, you're still going through the same feelings. Am I getting that?
Bang on. Now, how that leads to this new book, well, it's a bit of a long story, and it's a bit of a convoluted story, but I'll give it to you anyway. I read the Bhagavad Gita, the Vedic great spiritual work, about 20 years ago, and I was fascinated by the Battle of Purawashta, the part where Arjuna is on the field of the battle, and he suddenly sees his enemies before him, and he becomes filled with despondency, and then Krishna appears next to him in his chariot, and Krishna tells him that, you know, you must understand that this is not all there is to life. And basically one of the great spiritual dialogues of any kind of philosophy takes place, where Krishna is basically explaining to Arjuna that everything that's taken place on this field today is a product of what's taking place in the spiritual world. What, you know, as above, so below. What happens in heaven is reflected on earth. And that always stuck with me, okay? So I wanted to understand and find out, was there a European, especially as I began to understand the links between Vedic philosophy, Vedic spirituality, and the incredible synchronicities and links to the European version of that. Like, for instance, the Nordic god Indra is exactly Thor. You know, I wanted to know, you know, why was that so clear-cut? And then I said, well, the obvious thing is there a European version of the Bhagavad Gita, particularly that passage in the Bhagavad Gita, the despondency of Arjuna, okay? And so I found nothing really in the mythology. And then I started to look into the history, and I found it. It was April 30th. To May 1st, 1919, and it took place, of all places, in Munich in Bavaria in Germany. And yes, and it was the perfect example of what goes on in the spiritual world, both good and bad, being reflected in the material world. And what I discovered was, through this work, was that Europeans are living, even though we've had these horrific histories of these wars, First and Second World Wars, communism, fascism, and all that rubbish that goes along with it, what we're actually going through is a collective myth. Europeans are going through that now, and we've not noticed it because we see our education system and everything causes us to see things in cold, hard, analytical facts. So as I read this history, especially the occult aspects of it, which was very I have to be honest with you, very frightening to me at first. I didn't like I did not want to believe that all the horrors that were committed by both Nazis and Bolsheviks were a product of a kind of a dark spiritual battle taking place in another plane, because it almost sounds disrespectful to the people who've died. But the reality was, it was there. It was there. There was something wrong in the European psyche at a spiritual collective consciousness level that was manifesting in the most appalling acts on this continent. And I wanted to understand why that, and then I wanted to tell it. And when I figured out what was really going on, in my opinion, I'm not saying I'm completely right, this is my theory and my opinion, I felt that I'd actually tapped into something incredibly powerful. And the more I looked at academic histories of that particular period leading up to 1919 and then the rise of National Socialism, but also the rise of the Bolsheviks in Eastern Europe, I was starting to see a lot of those kind of synchronicities and realities that there's a, you know, we haven't, why this takes place in Europe is because we haven't sorted ourselves out at the top, in this consciousness, in a spiritual level, whatever. It's manifesting in the real world. What's not taken care of in heaven, as the Hindus say, is reflected on earth. And so anyway, that was the idea and why I started studying that period. Why I wrote File Purges Night and then the way I did was because I love history. I absolutely love it, but I hate history books. Because they're all factual and they don't tell the story in a way that actually you learn something. They don't resonate with your humanity. You know, in 1856 this happened, in 12 this happened. It's all very cold. It's all very analytical. You know, history is almost like explained to us in the same way an electronics engineer works his way through an electronic circuit board. Well, it's that human beings' experiences are not like that. And that's why things like mythology resonate so deeply with us. That's why people can read books like The Silmarillion by J.R.R. Tolkien, and it so deeply affects you. And you say, I wish this history was real. I wish it was real. The same thing when you can read the really good stuff in the Old Testament, like the Samson and Delilah. You know, you say, I wish that was, it's fantastic. It's what's this tell? Because you know it's telling you something that's beyond the material world. The same with the Celtic myths, the Irish myths, the Gaelic myths, Beowulf. You know, you're in the Anglo-Saxon thing, you're hit with the Native Americans. You're hit with something that hits you on a deep level. And my whole thing is like, well, why isn't regular history thought, you know, described and put across in this way? And so when I was starting to really research this period, and it was starting to hit me like a ton of bricks falling on my head, that this was something very big and very powerful, and had and should be like brought up in at least in the alternative movement. It came about. I decided to do it, even though everything in Valpurgis Night, the Volume 1, and as is Volume 2 and 3 that will come in the next few years, is based on real fact. I've told it in the style of a mythology, in the style of a thriller. And the reason why I did this was my previous book, The Anvil of the Psyche, a lot of people wrote to me and said the book was very good, but they said the part in the book where I wrote about John Lennon's assassination by Mark Chapman, they said it was one of the best things they ever read. They said it was like, you should be writing, like, you know, thrillers or that kind of thing, mystery stories. And then I said, well, if you really like that style, I'm going to do a whole book about it. And so that's how Valpurgis Night came about. It was about a reconciliation of the destruction of the European psyche, because we're not taking care of things in the spiritual world or the consciousness world, coupled with the fact that I believe that Europeans have to tell their history in the same way that they tell their history in the Vedic traditions and so forth. And even in, like, you know, everywhere, really, Europeans are the only ones that tell their history as a kind of a cold, analytical, facts and figures way, as a way to try and begin a dialogue. Okay, I'm not well known. I'm a small guy in the scheme of things, But if I can get enough people to sort of like spark off this idea that like maybe we should start looking at ourselves in a sort of a mythical way, it'll help us heal our problems better than looking at it in an analytical way. In the same way that James Joyce, Carl Jung, and Joseph Campbell described the actual idea of the monomyth, that you live your own life as a singular mythology, and that allows you to work through the problems in your own life much better. So, for instance, in the monomyth idea, which is beautifully expressed in James Joyce's novel Ulysses, the problems of everyday life are more than just your life being crap. They're much more than that. What you're really learning here is you're part of a mythology. Your life is a mythology in yourself. So if your girlfriend dumps you for another fella, you can be depressed for it, about it, but you must see it in kind of epic terms, that this is a learning experience to move to something else. If you get sacked from your job, if your job is rubbish, all kinds of things. If you can see them in mythological terms, in terms of the monomyth, you can approach them in a very much more healthy way than as you see them in cold, black and white terms. And I felt that on a macrocosm level, as Europeans, we needed to reclaim that. And I felt that the history of the rise of National Socialism, and particularly its conflict with the Bolsheviks, and then by extension in the later books, how that infected, and I do believe it is a kind of a consciousness infection, America, and then from that American imperialism, we have not addressed ourselves in a mythological term. So that's the idea behind these books and how they came about.
Wow, brilliant. Well, now, so essentially what you're talking about is the kind of what we call nowadays a Bilderberger meeting. Kind of thing, in that it brings together the leaders of the world and kind of passes out the memo, this is the agenda for the next.
Yes, precisely. And we actually believe that's real. But we don't actually, if we were actually to see the Bilderberg meeting, not as, okay, here's what I'm trying to get across in my way of explaining these things, right? Instead of seeing the Bilderberg meeting as a group of, you know, psychopathic or cold-blooded business people or bureaucrats or corporations, let's look upon them as a group of, now, we don't have, this is not literal, this is metaphorical now, as a cabal or a coven of demon kings assembling in a kind of a Tolkien way. This is, I'm talking about how our minds would actually look at it, assembling in order to, you know, make the human race suffer. So we sort of take them out of the cold business world and we put them into a mythological framework. And from that, we have a way to fight them. Because I can tell you, JP, and everyone else, you're not going to beat the Bilderbergs by seeing them in cold analytical terms and saying, we'll smash the system by going down there and protesting, waving a few flags. But if you can actually see this as a particular a quest in your own life against these people, on an individual level, you can declare war against them. For instance, you don't have to buy their Monsanto rubbish. You can grow your own food. That kind of thing. You can avoid them. So if you put it in, if you put that this battle in a mythological terms, you actually have a better chance of actually surviving it than you do if you say, oh, well, they have all the weapons and all the armies and all the power and all the taxes and everything. And who am I? I'm just a slave. I'm a status slave. You'll never win that. That's how they want you to be. Or else they want you rebelling against them, waving your SWP flag down outside the Bilderberg meeting. The way to do it is to actually see your own life in a monomyth and then see these challenges that you're dealing with as actually, you know, as I said, that word, in this case, a demonic cabal meeting. And when you see it that way, then you figure out a more intelligent and creative way to deal with it.
Excellent. So, where do I start to kind of agree with all that? Very much is what I talk about on my show. I live in my little world and I make my little world, you know, I have my little world dramas. And I was, you know, talking in the last show, this is a year ago, and I was having drains coming unblocked or drains blocking up. And, you know, all sorts of stuff coming through.
I remember your time.
Yeah. So those, to me, that's part of my battling. And, you know, since last year, I've also given up eating meat, which means I'm unfunding the death industry, which is what I've been, you know, this is what is causing us the problem, the death industry, the industry that runs from Monsanto all the way to Raytheon and arms companies, you know. Everything is about creating death and dealing with its aftermath, i.e. Halliburton rebuilding things or, you know the story. So my way of doing it is to unfund the death industry and fund the seeds industry. You know, make my own seeds and that. And I think I'm actually benefiting physically from it. I look better. I feel better. I've lost weight. I've lost, you know, maybe about 2 stone so far.
You definitely sound better.
Yeah.
You're a lot more buzzier and chipper than you were like last time we spoke.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, we have bad days. You know, I still have had a 9-day headache, but
but that's normal. Life is black and white. It's not all parties.
Yeah, that's right. So anyway, so we were talking about the Bilderbergers, and he said, "What about?" Tribal said, "I'd like to build a burger." I thought, "How about having a Bilderberger burger by mincing them all up?" But anyway,
can I just ask you a question then? I remember when you said that to me last time that you were having all kinds of problem with your drainage system, and I wasn't sure if you were talking in metaphor or in reality. Your septic tank backed up or something like that?
Yeah, what happened was the tank has an overspill that goes into a yard, and the yard had a very ancient ceramic drain pipe that a tractor had driven over. And it was catching on the loo paper, and it was blocking up. So, so it was actually about 100 yards away from me where the actual problem had happened. But he basically dug out all the drains, so that is future-proofed the drain system for at least for a good.
Okay, now let me ask you another question, right? So that was a physical problem with your drainage system. While that was going on, did you have recurring problems or issues in your own life from, say, that you were dealing with emotionally?
I would say that there was drainage is about being able to throughput, you know, being able to get rid of waste and all that stuff. So losing weight is that, you know, you're getting rid of toxins, and sometimes you can't get rid of all of them at the same time, and I think that's probably about it. Take things a little more slowly and subtly, and not being in a hurry.
I can tell you for a fact, not just myself, but other people, when we were going through an emotional crisis in a family, or in a home, or in a relationship, I can tell you for a fact appliances break down. They stop working. Anything electrical, you'll have more breaks. Your oven will burn out, your hair dryers will go, your TV will pack in, your computer will pack in. I found that very common story over the years. If there was a lot of emotional energy that wasn't being resolved in the home, appliances would break down because the flow of energy was not passing through the appliance.
That's right. It's not grounding out. I was actually talking to somebody the other day, when they have a polished crystal, because of their rapport with it, they don't ground out the crystal. They charge the thing up and they blow up.
Wow!
So because of the already stressed, because of, you know, you traumatize a crystal by polishing it. And unless it can be de-stressed, it holds a stress in it, and adding more energy like that, the thing just explodes. So watch out, all you people.
Let me tell you something that happened about I don't know how long, but 6 months ago, I had a radio show on Sunday night on Type One, and I did a special where an investigation I'd done into Jimmy Savile being a serial killer was done that on the air that live that night, and the show was like did very well for me, and I actually put a lot of evidence together to show that actually Savile, and I do believe this sincerely, was involved at Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper.
Let's go there because yeah. I've got more info on that.
Let me explain something before we get to that, right? The day after I did that show, my internet failed, right? And I have the junction box on the wall here, which is the phone in one line, the internet line in the other. And I couldn't, the phone calls were scratchy and the internet wasn't working. So I called up the local telecom company here. They came out and your man opened up the box, the engineer opened up the box in my house now, the one on the wall. And he said to me, was the house hit by lightning the other day? And I says, no. And he showed me the circuit board and it was fried.
Fried? Fried. Wow. Excellent.
Yeah. And I don't know, and it was like, that's what, and he says to me, I've never seen anything like this in my life. Are you sure you weren't, sure the house wasn't hit by lightning? I says, lightning never happens around here unless in the summer. And that's it. You get like, it's still rare, and the house has never been hit, or even a tree nearby has never been hit. Actually, a tree in the yard was hit about 10 years ago, a tall one. But that was very, very rare. And it definitely wasn't hit by lightning that night. And so that's, isn't that interesting too? The same kind of idea.
Awesome, awesome. Well, you know, I'm, my trade, my profession, one time was IT. I worked in the universities and I basically did like, I've done helplines all my life and rebuilt computers and all this stuff. And so I've got quite an awareness of computers since 1980, you know, personal computers. And when personal computers first started happening, I found that people divided into three groups. People had no weirdness with them. People who had negative weirdness, people had positive weirdness. So people with negative weirdness tend to be the very, very nervous types, you know, the fussy nervous type. And they have a kind of annoying field around them. And that annoyance field tends to mess up computers. And I've got
you
the
mean
opposite.
Like a kind of edgy,
yes,
nebbishy kind of thing.
Nebbishy, yeah. Yeah. People who they'll be they'll be stuttering, right? Yeah. They'll be trying to, you know, push their energy out through the holes that are too small to accept it. It happens around their computers, and they would always break down because they're always trying to type too fast. And then there are other people, myself included, and I make computers go right. So people would ask me along, and I would come up to their office, and they say that your computer's not running. So I'd turn it on, and it turned on, and it worked. And probably it's, you know, the matter of turning it off and turning it on again, like the IT group, you know. That is so true. That anybody sees the IT crowd, that's what they always say. Hello, help, yeah, have you tried turning it off and turning it on? It's because that's the best thing to do with a computer if it goes wrong. So, yeah, so I found this kind of three groups of people who are affected positively, or people who affect machines positively, people who affect machines negatively, and people within the middle of the bell curve where everything's normal, yeah. But do you have electrical? Do you get that electrical interference and things with your body?
Yes, but I'm quite good with electronics. I studied a year in electronic engineering in college, so I get it and I've no problem with it. But I know when I have emotional problems, which is probably just like you said, the first crowd who work up this kind of negative kind of thing about it. I know it does affect electronic and electrical appliances in my home. It does. They're more likely to fail all at once if they're near the edge, you know, that kind of a thing. And that's definitely to do with, like, I'm not feeling well or I'm not feeling right about things.
Mm. And, you know, obviously the room in your house is also affects, you know, the part of your body will affect the room in the house where these things happen. You know.
Oh yeah, well it's like, you know those houses, and I don't care what anyone says, I've seen houses around here where people have left or died, and the house died. I'm not just saying, it's not just because it went damp and there was no heating inside it, because I've seen it happen to the modern houses where the people moved away. The house literally died.
Oh.
It literally began to die because there was no life inside it, and the roof would start to sag. You'd see it very quickly, very quickly. You might have someone living there for years and the house is in good nick, and then they died or they moved away, and the house would literally begin to eat itself alive and fall apart. And it was the presence of the people, and I'm not, it's more than just having the heating on and dealing with the damp. It's more than that. Their life energy was keeping that house from falling in on itself.
Very interesting. So let's talk about Jimmy and also Myra, because we were sort of in correspondence. You know, so tell us a little more about how you figured out how did you make the connection that Saville and Sutcliffe were connected in that way, and then I'll give you my input on what I think might be going on.
Well, I had David J. Yallop's book, a fantastic investigative journalist from the 70s and 80s. He wrote a book called Pure Evil about the history of the Ripper case, the Yorkshire Ripper case, with Sutcliffe as it was going on. So he was there on the ground. The book's a very good read, by the way. He was like an embedded journalist before that term became popular within the South Yorkshire and West Yorkshire police force. And he was monitoring the case as it was going on and as the latter murders happened. And he described in the book a case that was being thrown into absolute and total chaos by the cops. And he said Sutcliffe was definitely the murderer, but he believed that there was somebody else, and that somebody else was somebody the cops did not want to catch, right? So that was interesting to me at first. I read that book years ago, by the way, long before the Saville stuff came out. Now, when this started to glue together for me was when that, what was his name? Theroux, that guy, Louis Theroux.
Louis Theroux, yeah.
Had that TV show where he spent the week with famous celebrities in there. And he was with Jimmy Savile. This is back in the 90s now. And I was over in my mate's house and we were drinking coffee and watching this. And I'm looking at Savile. Now, this is when I started to really study the psychopath stuff, but there wasn't a lot of stuff out there. So I was mostly reading, criminal profiling things and, you know, those kinds of books like by detectives and criminal profiles dealing with things like serial killers, because that was the only hard evidence you could get. And I'm sitting there watching Saville. Now, I never liked Saville as a kid anyway. I never liked those TV shows. And I'm watching it, and he's over his apartment, and what struck me was the first thing he says was, he says, women are brain damage.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
And the second that was said, after he showed the mother's clothes, no, it was later on, as soon as he said that, I said to my mate as a joke, he's a feckin' serial killer. And my mate burst out laughing. And he says, how do you know? I says, that's a giveaway. Women are brain damaged. That's a very strange thing to say. And then when they went to visit his mother's apartment, then they showed his bed, and his bed was called the altar. And that was creepy enough by itself. And even Louis Theroux said, what happens on altars, Jimmy? People are sacrificed. And then they went to his mother's house in Scarborough, and he had all her frocks and gowns, the Duchess as he called her, all perfectly preserved. And I was looking at this, and I said, and even my mate said to me, it's like Norman Bates, isn't it? And I says, I'm telling you, that guy is a serial killer, right? And then I said, he's killed people, I'm telling you. Or else he's watched it or something like that. And he was laughing at me, my friend. And then when the Saville stuff came out and he goes, you know, the Operation U-Tree things, after just after he died, conveniently, and he was saying to me, "You really had Savile nailed. I think you're right. I think he might have been more than just a kiddie fiddler. There must be or a groper. There was a sex offender. There's something going on there." And he says to me, "Do you remember when he said that? When he said women are brain damaged?" And I says, "Yeah, I don't know why I said that, but it reminds me of something." And then I went through my books and I found the David A. Yallop book on Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper. And I remembered that the murders had been committed by hitting the women on the back of the head with a ball end hammer, the hammer that's used by metal workers to hammer sheet metal into shape. It's a very specific type of hammer. It doesn't have a claw on the back for removing nails as a ball. And that's what Sutcliffe used it. But I can tell you for a fact, it's very difficult. I was talking to a friend who was a Scotland Yard detective, and he said it's very difficult to kill a human being. That they will, when they want to live, they will do everything to live. And no matter how strong the person is doing it. And I never understood how Sutcliffe was able to kill these women so easily. And then I looked through the book and found out that one of the murders literally took place behind Savile's apartment in Leeds. Another one took place on the grounds of the Royal Infirmary Hospital in Manchester, where Savile used to do his quote-unquote charity work, which was having sex with dead bodies in the morgue. And then it hit me. The two of them were together. And then to my amazement, the Daily Mirror produces a photograph of a picture of Savile introducing the boxer Frank Bruno to Sutcliffe in Broadmoor Hospital. And then it just all fell into place for me then. And then I looked at the maps, studied the timelines, and came to the conclusion, that's why I call him the 666 killer, 666 killer, excuse me, because the murders had taken a long place from the M6, the M26, and the M6. Right across a board, a line from Preston down through Manchester across to Leeds. And all those towns in between, like Halifax, and I think there was one, I have the map there somewhere, but those towns around that area. So even calling him the Yorkshire Ripper, was a diversion, because some of the murders happened in Lancashire, in around Manchester. And coupled with the fact that Yallop had come to the conclusion that there was somebody else involved, even though Sutcliffe had done it, and the police investigation was thrown into chaos in order to protect this person. Now, the TV show in the set at that time, the late 70s, called Man Alive, which is weird enough as itself. It went up there to Sheffield, was it? It's one of those cities up there in Yorkshire. And they had met with both the West Yorkshire and the South Yorkshire police. And they came to the same conclusion that the cops were deliberately throwing the investigation into chaos. And they couldn't understand why. And the reason was they were protecting Jimmy Savile. And I've taken a lot of flack for this, but I have no doubt about it, that the day will come when Jimmy Savile will be implicated as an accomplice with Peter Sutcliffe, with the Yorkshire Ripper, and it will happen. I know it for a fact. The two of them were working together in the late 70s, in that part of England. And I, the more I look at it, even now, even though it kind of gives me the creeps, the night that the murders happened, Savile was definitely not on either Top of the Pops or his other show.
So that, I mean, this is absolutely fascinating material, Thomas, but I think it gets even deeper. Because, okay, we know several things. We know that Savile called his mother the Duchess.
Yeah.
We also know that people who do this kind of thing don't tend to come from the lower classes.
Nope.
And we've also learned that the bloodline find and look after their own. I am thinking that the Duchess was an illegitimate daughter of one of the of a bloodline,
Well, if you're right here now, I'd slap you a high five. You're absolutely right. You are absolutely right. She was the bastard offspring of one of them, and they do look after their own. And that's what made him untouchable and friends of royalty. And that's why, you're exactly right, he called her the Duchess. Yep, absolutely. And he also had, and was given, the occult powers that these people use. He had them. To hypnotize people, to brainwash them, to play on their minds. His own history is very strange. It's conflicting, contradictory. One minute he's a miner, the other down the mines, that kind of miner. And
probably was
a coal mine. And then the other one is that he didn't do national service because he was too sick as a child, and all these kinds of things. It's very, very vague. He had incredible power, not just in the UK. I found photographs of him in the Irish Parliament, meeting with the Prime Ministers here, staying in their homes, staying in the houses of billionaire Irish families, business families. And he had an open door, a key to everything. And the reason was, yes, that's why. And that's why the whole thing of Jack the Ripper, the whole thing of that, the Jack the Ripper was actually like the Queen's nephew or something, Queen Victoria's nephew. I think that theory is as valid as ever. And I think Savile was the same.
Totally. Because, as I said, I think it gets deeper. So, we have Savile being bloodline. We have also this other phenomenon which happened, which seemingly kind of like it's like a continuousness of it. And this is what we call the Moors murders. Now, what I'm thinking here, Thomas, is that these bodies are simply the leftovers, as it were, from rituals.
Yes.
What do you think of that? And instead of that Savile or the, you know, Sutcliffe were actually doing it, maybe they're just getting rid of the stiffs, and, you know, taking advantage of the stiffs as Savile used to do. sorry, this is at 3 o'clock in the afternoon for California. Sorry about this, but anyway, the Savile was dealing with the stiffs because that's you know, his uncle, you know, had this issue. He needed to get rid of the things, and so basically, one of the problems that the Toffs have is they have trouble getting rid of the dead bodies after their satanic rituals, and so they blame it on so-called serial killers. And probably Ripper is a code word to say, don't investigate this, guys, because it's actually the Toffs who are doing it themselves. What do you think?
I think that's very valid and definitely worth exploring further. Now, regarding people don't know about this, the Moored murderers, in the 1960s, the early to mid-60s, there was a couple in Manchester called Ian Brady and Moira Hindley, who abducted children, tortured them, recorded it on audio tape, and then buried them in the moors outside Manchester. Now, what this ties to Savile in a few ways. Firstly, Savile was one of the original presenters of Top of the Pops, and he was a DJ doing very well, DJing and also doing music promotion for bands as big as the Beatles, by the way, in the northeast of England, in Manchester and Liverpool. He was based in Manchester, very close to where Ian Brady and Murray Hindley lived. So that's one connection, right? The original Top of the Props program in Manchester took place in a church, which is strange enough in itself. A former church that had been converted into a pop studio.
Did it so?
A TV studio. What's that?
Did it so? How very interesting.
Oh yeah, it's gone now, I believe, but it was a big old Gothic church. Now, Brady definitely did kill the first victim. It was a young 17-year-old guy called John Kilbride. Brady definitely did that. He strangled him in front of, he was actually a local street kid. and he strangled him in front of Hindley in the apartment to test her to see if she was okay with murder, which is weird in itself. And then it got darker. Now, were these kids given to Hindley and Brady, the Moore's murderers, from Saville and that crowd? Very possible. I'm not going to say likely, but I'll say very possible. Two reasons. They were close by. Same part. Very, very close by, actually. Like, you're talking about, like, not that far apart, right? Secondly, she definitely had, Maura Hindley definitely had an MK Ultra type personality in a British version. She had suffered tremendous trauma all through her childhood, was raped by her alcoholic father. She was not naturally psychopathic. Brady absolutely was. And so she became a mind-controlled slave for this network, of which Brady was like a fixer, a gangster. I also think, and I know this sounds mad to a lot of people, that Jimmy Savile modeled his physical image on Maura Hindley's infamous arrest photograph when she was arrested by the cops in Manchester. He had black hair naturally before that infamous 1966 photograph of her arrest, and that very spooky and strange photograph of Maura Hindley when she was arrested. Savile had black hair before that. Now, so, and then suddenly there was a period around 1967 when the trial was at, the Moore's murderers trial was at its height, where Savile dyed his hair two colors. It was black on one side and blonde on the other, which that has other connotations with Masons and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, we'll be talking about that in a little while with my personal experience of Savile. Anyway.
Oh, go on, that's going to be good. And then he went full blonde when she was found guilty and sent to prison for forever, right? So, now somebody sent me a photograph saying, Thomas, you're wrong. Here's a picture of Savile standing in front of the charts from before Maura Hindley was arrested, and he had blonde hair. But I've been looking at that photograph, JP, and the more I look at it, it looks like it's been doctored. It's hard to tell because it's a TV studio, but I'm an artist. I know about where light direction, where light and shadow falls. And he looks like that photograph's been, like a famous Lee Harvey Oswald photograph, where he's been stuck with the gun in his hand to frame him. It's like that. It doesn't look right. It looks like the photograph has been doctored. Almost like a backstory for Savile. Now, I could be wrong about that, but it doesn't look right to me. And it's only the one photo. And the person who brought this to my attention was like an unknown person who emailed me. And when I emailed them back, the email didn't exist.
So, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Interesting. So,
Savile, I think, well, I don't think, it's a hypothesis that he modeled his physical image on Maura Hindley.
Well,
and also to do a joke, like, everybody in Britain hates Maura Hindley. They want her dead, and he's on television going, I'm really her. I'm the one that really did it.
All right, well, this takes us deeper, because we also learn that certain satanic ceremonies, whether you believe in Satan or not, but Satanists believe in their thing and they do this stuff. Satanic ceremonies, the priestess has long blonde hair.
Yeah.
And it may be that, Savile might have had an even deeper, he may have been a hermaphrodite, you never know. But he may be like the British Sai Baba. Anyway, long story. But that Savile had that he became that. This, my hypothesis is that Hindley, before her arrest, was made the priestess, and then Savile took over, and so he could have had his hair blonde at that moment. And this sounds even weirder. Like, if you want to get weirder than your weird theory, this is weird where weird takes off and becomes weirder.
Well, it's even nothing surprises me anymore.
Yeah, tell you, mate.
You know, like, was Saville a black magician, right? Well, okay, he had a wand that was a cigar. You ever notice that? The cigar, that was his wand,
so
right?
So he did. He had his magical word.
The energy, right? And what did you... Jingle, jangle, jingle, jangle, jingle, jangle. Right, we know that. That's actually a spell. Abracadabra, abracadabra, always on Jimmy's feet. Abracadabra, abracadabra, alakazam, jingle, jangle, jingle, jangle. And you know, like, he had this incredible power. And then, it ties up with so many other things. You had Cyril Smith, right? Another notorious paedophile, right?
Okay, well, hang on. Cyril Smith, we have to describe it to our American viewers, is the kind of Rob Ford of British politics. He's dead now, isn't he?
But yeah, he died about a couple of years ago.
And probably from eating too much. That's probably why. I mean, he was like... there are several. They're, you know, enormous, like, tick-like beings.
He was like... do you remember that
Jabba
movie?
The Hutt.
That movie Dune, the book's Dune.
Yeah, yeah.
There was
yeah,
the
Dune.
Head of one of the planets, and he was this huge guy.
Harkonnen.
Yes, and he would consume young boys. That's what Cyril Smith was like.
Holy crap, yeah. He just kind of ripped the blood cord out of them, and they would just bleed out.
While he was raping them.
Yeah, yeah.
Harkonnen used to rape them while killing them to harvest their life energy.
Exactly.
Cyril Smith was like that.
Yeah, and it's like tick. It's like a tick, you know, the deer tick. So, we've talked about that as well. But anyway, let's see. We may go down that dark corridor, but we may just stay on the upper levels here. So, Thomas, we're looking at Saville, and we're looking at Hindley, and we're looking at this bloodline with their predilection for raping and killing beings, you know, young beings, virgins, basically children. I think when they say virgins, they mean children. So
yeah.
If we actually say children and not virgins, which, you know, makes things a lot more, it puts things into place. Because you think of a virgin, you think of a girl, or you know, you think of a 40-year-old virgin, you know, have all these connotations about it. But if you say a child, you know exactly what you're talking about.
Well,
go on.
You know, back to the Cyril Smith thing, the reason why I interject that in there is because he was the MP for Rochdale, which is a town in Greater Manchester, just outside the city. And during when he was the MP there, there was a thing called the Satanic Scare, the Satanic Panic, where two social workers in Rochdale heard stories of children saying that they were being molested by men dressed as a devil, who gave them wine and chocolates and sweets, and molested them. And these two social workers went out and basically fingered all their parents and said their parents were involved in a satanic child abuse ritual. Now, it was total bullshit, and these were sort of poor working class families who couldn't defend themselves intellectually or financially. And so, but eventually the thing blew over. But the children said something very interesting, and this is from a friend of mine who was a social worker in Rochdale. And she says, here's what really happened. The kids were taken to a big house outside Rochdale, where there was a big fat man and a man with blonde hair dressed as, this is what some of the late 80s now, dressed as a devil, who gave them wine and interfered with them, molested them, right? And then they were brought back home. There's only two people that could fit that profile. That's Cyril
Smith. And it's not Laurel and Hardy.
Yeah, Cyril Smith and Saville.
Holy crap.
Yeah. And it's up the road. It's the same part of England.
So let's just put this into context. What we're talking about is a gentleman who was a male potential human. It gets worse. Who in the middle part of the island of Britain, Actually where like Oasis come from, and you know, all these great bands. and they called it, you know, the Dark Satanic Mills. That's the area that they're talking about, and so there is a kind of a dark satanic tradition in that area. And what we're seeing is an outpouring, this is like the spillage that is coming out of this thing as greater consciousness and awareness comes on online, and we're all able to see everything. All, you know, we can tune into satellites and we can see what's going on in real time and all this stuff, or near real time at least. But what we're seeing is a gradual uncovering of the darkness that is what hides behind and purports to be the people who are so-called in authority to us. And so we're beginning to see the dismantling and the destruction of authority and institution. But it could be giving way to simply corporation and brand loyalty, brand religion.
Well, that's and transhumanism.
And transhumanism. So, yeah. We'll go there in the next segment. I think we'll take a little break in a minute, and I'm going to play Talking Head Psycho Killer. Mwahaha. Anyway, so yes, hello. With demonic, right? Okay, so Talmudic. So somebody's coming in. M432. Talmudic immorality, asininity, and pornography. The reprobate mind. So yes, well, comeandhear.com. There we go. Joris Demning. Right. So we have a Dutch listener here. Could Mr. Sheridan give his vision on this guy, who is Mr. PR? PR Newswire. I'll give you the link there, Thomas, so you can have a look at that. Maybe Thomas will have a look at that after the show, Swami, after the break. Thank you for listening. We are Ever Beyond on Wolf Spirit Radio and everbeyondradio.com. And here's a little break. Let's Psycho Killer. Yeah, what else? Psycho Killer. I love that one. I play this one with my band, or did play. I don't know. I don't think I've got a band anymore. I think the drummer and the singer have just been posted elsewhere, and we got nobody. And so, it's a long story. But I used to love playing that one because you have to go really mad at the end with the tremolo, and I try not to break strings by stretching.
Yeah, it's a fun song to play.
Yeah. So, do you play bass or do you play lead?
I play rhythm guitar, a little bit of lead, and I play bass as well. But I play the banjo and the mandolin and a few other things like that as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, indeed, you are a multi-talented... I mean, we're talking about your psychological artistry, but, you have, as you say, you're a musician, you paint, and you've been selling your paintings, which is great, and you've been writing, and you've been writing books, and you've been selling books, so that's brilliant. So you're a kind of complete enterprise Renaissance character, so hat tip to you, my friend.
I'm just fortunate that I've had, you know, the ability to learn these ideas and these skills, so I'm very grateful that I can actually make a living outside the matrix. That makes me happy.
Indeed. I think that's where we're all going. And you know what we were saying earlier before we came on the show about getting a farm together or like micro farming and just living in communities and tribes. And you don't need any of the bureaucracy. We don't need bureaucracy. It just makes things. Because the only reason we have cities is to feed the bureaucracy. So if we didn't have bureaucracy, we wouldn't need to feed this central beast, and everybody would have enough, because we wouldn't need to go anywhere, because everybody has enough. Anyway, long story. So, where were
we? Tell me about your... you said you had a personal experience of Savile.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it was interesting, because when you're talking about the whole dyed half of the hair... thing is, now I went to a recording. I lived in London, so sometimes you'd go along to watch radio shows, as you do at the BBC, and I went to Shepherd's Bush, I think. And it might have been the one in the West End, I can't remember. Anyway, I went to this airing, and there he was, and I was in like the second row towards the edge. But there he was, so he's about like 30 feet from me. And he had half of his beard shaved off that night. Like, so one side was clean shaven and the other half was shaven. And you saying this whole thing about the satanic rituals, isn't there something about having one half face and another half face? Is like,
yeah, the Harlequin kind of thing. The split personality thing. It's a black and white, the dual thing. Yeah, it's like I present one face to the world, but there's one, it's a psychopathic thing, but the other part of me is hidden. And that was a big, you know, that he was full of that. He was nothing else but that.
Exactly. Oh, this is very interesting. And it's great we've got some British listeners here. And here's more. So Dave from the UK, he was saying, this is getting too weird. As you know, there have been a lot of synchronicities in the last few days, I have to say. More per square millimetre, I have to say there. Anyway, so this is too weird. I worked in all these places. I met Savile. He was weird. And everyone I work with now who worked with children at the time, who still work in Rochdale Council, all knew what the children were saying about Cyril Smith, who's the big fat guy, many, many people of a certain age, in the 50s and 60s. So it's taken all this time for the truth to filter out. And so he then goes on to say, is it possible that Hindley and Sutcliffe actually carried on satanic practices whilst in prison against such people?
Yes. Hindley, especially... What was happening? No, sorry. Sutcliffe and Hindley were locked up in prison, and there's bodies that are still missing, right? And what's interesting about Hindley is you had all these like lords and toffs visiting her in the prison, and saying she's a wonderful person, she should be released, and all this kind of shit.
Sorry, you can say shit. It's fine.
Oh, okay. I didn't know I was on commercial. But anyway, she deliberately withheld the location of the two missing bodies of children for two reasons. One, until the day she died, that was kind of like the black magic act. It gave her power. And two, it was because it would give Brady a sexual thrill. She was having black magic, sex magic with Brady by teasing the world about the location of the two bodies. And she was actually playing black magic sex games with him through the media. Now, when she died, he was ruthless describing her. Like, he said that she stitched me up, I'd be free now if it wasn't for her. So, I go back and forth on the Hindley Brady thing. I saw, you know, Brady was absolutely a psychopath. There's no doubt about that. When Leslie Ann, what was her name? I can't remember the second girl's name. Leslie Ann something. She was one of the little girls who was tortured, and they recorded her torture and murder, as gruesome as this is, on audio tape. And Brady made a copy of the tape. And when during the course, the court case came out, they asked Brady, why did you make multiple copies of the tape of Leslie Ann, well, I can't remember her second name, Downey, being tortured, the little girl. He said it was because it was interesting. I believe those tapes were being actually shipped among the satanic networks.
Exactly.
That's why it's extra. And he just made that bullshit up because of that reason. She was on the tape. I've never heard the tapes, but I've seen the transcripts. I don't want to ever hear the tapes. But in the transcripts, she's saying "shut up" while the little girl is crying, telling her to behave herself while she's being satanically abused by Brady. I mean, this is the kind of crap that was going on. This is how dark it was, right? And yes, there are other, someone has said, someone's pointed out that there are voices of other people in the background of that tape. I've never heard the tape. And you wonder if one of those people in the background was someone like Saville.
I imagine that there was quite a group there.
Yeah. As horrible as that is to think about.
Well, yeah. But see, it goes further. Are you aware of abledanger.net?
I know the website. I don't visit it.
Okay, well, the guy who... there's two guys. There's one's a pilot, and the other guy is... He's been many things. His name's David Hawkins. But he has been talking about these worshipful guilds, for a start, which is things that people don't know about, but these are groupings of all different professions and trades, trade guilds, and the patent network, and the network that is run by the lesbian, gay, transsexual set, called FemComp Inc. Have you heard of FemComp?
I have, yeah.
Yeah. So these are the guys that run the communications networks, and on 9/11 they had the thing they call the football. It wasn't with the president; it was with FemComp. So basically, this kind of radical lesbian transhumanist group is basically taking over the world through that side. But one of the things that he talks about are oath-taking ceremonies. And oath-taking ceremonies are often, you have to first, you know, like Hindley, like these things you were describing that were going on with Hindley, witnessing, and finally becoming like that. That's part of the oath-taking hierarchy. So they've always got something on you because they got you filmed doing it, but they also get off selling these films, and people buy these films for vast amounts of money.
Like a snuff kind of film.
It's
yeah.
a snuff movie. It's the worst kind of snuff movie. And in fact, 9/11, they say, was a public snuff movie.
Oh, it was, yeah.
Because do you remember? Let's have a good old moan about the old days. Remember the old days? You never saw anyone get killed on TV.
Picture of a dead body in a newspaper.
Exactly. Never saw it. And it's a shock. And I believe it's a shock to traumatize us as much as possible. We're flooded with trauma to keep us in a state of fear, which is why I'm sitting here on the outskirts of nowhere, speaking to somebody else who might be another sane voice in this insane ocean.
Yeah, well, we're lucky we have the internet to actually talk to each other.
Totally, it's great, isn't it? So let's talk about, yeah, so the idea that these public figures also have this dark side, but that they've also got a protective mechanism, a protective network around them, because not only are they involved in the oath-taking ceremonies, but all the Masons are involved with the oath-taking ceremonies now. And this is why none of them can talk, because they know what it means.
Yes, and there's also tremendous rewards. You know, the there's enormous rewards financially, politically, etc. It's just, you know, like you said, that if Saville's mother was the Duchess and she was related to royalty, look at the rewards that Saville enjoyed.
Exactly.
So think of the rewards that anyone who's on the same team would enjoy.
So let's take it today. Let's take it to today. Can you see people out there, Thomas? I mean, because I tell you, I am totally uninterested. I don't watch TV. I don't read the newspapers. I don't buy their propaganda, literally. How do you see the same kind of processes going on? You know,
In what context?
Like, is there a Jimmy Savile of today?
Is there? Of course there is. Yeah. Of course there is. There's probably hundreds of them. These bastards never change. There'll be hundreds of them working out there. We just hear his name because he was the witch every so often that they actually give us in public. But there's a thousand witches behind the scene who they hide. Of course there is. Yeah, absolutely. They're happening in Scotland or where you are, in Ireland where I am, in the US and Canada, you name it. They're all over. England, they're everywhere. They're absolutely, they're out there. And they tell us about it after they die. They mock us by saying, oh, he's dead. Oh, he died. And guess what? He was an evil pedophile. They mock us. They wait till they die and then they tell us, like Cyril Smith.
Yeah, there was that other guy, Soames. One woman said, it's like having a wardrobe fall on you with the key sticking out.
Yeah.
So, from these ugly ticks of politicians, because, you know, have you ever actually done a stand-up? Because, like, some nights you're on Facebook and you're kind of, you're banging them out, you know, you're really throwing out the...
Yeah, I used to write comedy years ago. And I love comedy and I love satirical, I love satire. And I've actually done a big gig in Dublin recently for, which has actually been made into a movie called some, can I say the F word in this channel?
You can say whatever you like.
Yeah, there's a film coming out called Some Fucker's Son. And I'm in it. And it's about myself and a group of other Irish sort of like, activists, whatever you want to call them, were given a training in how to be a stand-up comic and put on a stage in a packed Dublin venue, a comedy venue. And I didn't tell them, but I'd done this before years ago. And so it was natural to me. No, I actually think that, you know, I my health hasn't been the best in the last year or so. And I have been able to do talks and stuff like that, but I'm starting to feel better now. When I get out there, I want to start selling these ideas through the comedy, because I think it's the best way of getting this stuff into the mainstream. I think that's the best way to do it for now.
I think you're right.
I think to follow the Bill Hicks, Carlin kind of thing. I think that for now, the best way to get the stuff into the mainstream is through comedy and satire. I've been doing this for years now, and I want to actually take it to the next level, and you know what they call the true movement or whatever you want to call it. I want to get out there on stage and do it. Now I know I'm good at it. I'm very good at writing funny jokes about it, but it's a great way. It's a brilliant way of delivering the truth.
Oh, it certainly is. And you know, people have got such love and respect for these icons, you know, the Bill Hicks and the George Carlins, you know, they're dead now. Who do we have? Russell Bland. Yes, he's very bought. And who else? Who's that? There was an Australian guy who I quite liked.
Yeah, he's good. Steve Hughes.
Yeah.
And Frankie Boyle, the Scottish chap, can be quite cutting as well.
He's been sacked by the BBC basically for telling them they're all paedophiles, which is actually true. And it's
and there's an American chap, Reginald D. Hunter. He's very good too. But that's definitely something I want to do. I'd love to do a stand-up tour of like the UK, just like doing this stuff to try and pull in the mainstream.
Excellent. Well, I mean, why don't you get... You could get onto a Live at the Apollo or something like that. That would be a...
I doubt that, but I'd be happy to do it. I'd be delighted just a club for the 20 people. I'd be delighted with that.
All right. Well, anyway. Yeah, I'm sure you get a gig at Findhorn as well. once your name's around. Because, you know... People in the truth movement have often been abused. And life can get really serious.
Yeah.
And light is light is light, as far as I can see. You know, light is light in weight, it is light in color, and it lightens the spirit. And so keep everything light, even if we're going down some dark corridors, because, you know, that's how they do it in films, don't you know? They have a really serious bit, and then they have a bit of comedy where the heroine falls over and falls flat on her face, which is usually what happens, isn't it? So, meanwhile, down the dark corridors, where were we?
I asked you about Sabbath, and you told me that story.
Oh, yes.
And then a chap said something about Cyril Smith and Rochdale.
Oh, yes. So, basically, there was that you were talking about the children who had seen the fat man and the thin blonde.
Yeah.
And all that. And then we also have M432 here saying, arch-pedophile Jimmy Savile was a devout Zionist and an Israel supporter. Gilad Atzmon.
I think he was just a classic psychopath in that he pretended to be everybody's friend to try and brown nose and like manipulate people. I don't think he gave a shit about anyone. When he was in Ireland, he was a huge hibernophile. You know, he was like, everything Ireland is great, the Irish are great, blah, blah, I love Ireland, my favorite country in the world. Then he would go to Israel, oh, I love Israel, oh, you know, he was a typical psychopath talking bollocks, that's really what he was. Brown-nosing people to like try and win their touch, their trust.
Talking bollocks.
He didn't give a shit about the Middle East, it was just like to make himself look, to big himself up.
He actually went to the Israeli cabinet, didn't he? And hey, bloody blaming him, they're telling this government what to do. That was an interesting
thing. Well, there you go. The Duchess thing again. He had the you know, if you're a member of royalty, you have the open door to all these parliaments. That's why he had the open door to the Irish Parliament, the British Parliament, the Israeli Parliament, and Australia, wherever country he was popular in. The same bullshit.
That's right. So, he's I think, and the other, all right. So let's talk more about Savile, because you know when I look at something, I try to find as much as I can about like all the whole side of it, and they're very interesting things, and they also link together with other stories. So there's this. Let's look at the thread that Savile had. Keys to Broadmoor, to Stoke Mandeville, which is a children's hospital for disabled children.
Spinal injuries.
I'm sorry?
And also the Royal Infirmary in Manchester.
And Haute de la Reine in Jersey.
Yep.
And the children, you know, you name it. Wherever there was a children's home, Savile had a key. Because he was a charity worker and he raised so much money for the children. Oh, think of the children. You don't want to let down the children. If you get me into trouble, think of the children. That's how he used to do it, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. And he did raise a lot of money. It was a fantastic cover story.
I also think that money was money that was made by criminal members of his satanic society.
Yeah, and they probably channeled it into other things.
Yep, yep. Yep, yep. So, wow. It's all right. In the chat room, calm down. Everybody calm down. Everybody's welcome. Doesn't matter. Let's not put the gun down and step away. So, what the heck is going on now? So we're talking. I'm just having a look at the chatters and seeing what's going on here. Two-Face, yeah, yeah. So where were we? Yeah, serial killers, psychopaths, paedophiles, Nazis—the usual thing. So yeah, okay, all right. Look, if there's anybody got anything for me in the chat room, just put it in uppercase, okay? So, and deal with it peacefully. See if you learn something from all these programs I've been doing for the last 4 years. Anyway, welcome Thomas Sheridan to Ever Beyond. Don't worry about the chat room, everything's fine. So we're talking about the way that Saville fitted in to this larger context of children's homes being used as places to funnel children to their eventual torture and death at the hands of satanic rings run by the entire establishment that runs not only Britain but all of Europe and all of America through the military over there. Over here it's been, and also through the church and all of that stuff. The whole kind of network is beginning to be, the underground is being lifted up to be shown. I think this is good news. Although it's ugly, it's been going on, and the good news is that we're seeing it. Don't you?
Yeah. The shadow was being revealed. It's how you deal with it that's important. You can actually turn away from it and say, oh, I don't want to hear about that. And there's a few things, there's quite a few things that I feel that way about. I don't want to go there just yet. But it is important that we recognize the fact that there's a dark undercurrent to the world that we live in order to deal with it. It's as simple as that.
And it's really the exposure that is the key to it. We just need to make people aware that what the TV is a complete film of lies. You know, it's a little like that. What's that stuff? No, not formica. It's the plastic cupboard with the flowers on it that you stick over your wheelie bin. It's that plastic film that covers
sticky
over
back,
it.
Sticky back plastic.
Yeah. I'll remember the brand name in a minute, and whatever it is, it's like.
But formica is a good egg. Is a good analogy too. Yeah.
Exactly. So, they call that the archonic overlay. Now, you were talking on another place about Valpurgis Night being that you went in with a kind of skeptical, wanting to debunk it. Kind of you,
yeah.
Or was that another project of yours?
No, that was true. I didn't believe the whole thing of that the elite were involved in the occult. I honestly didn't believe it. I thought that, okay, it sounds fantastic. Is it true or not? I don't believe so. I just think they're just criminal psychopaths and gangsters. And I went in, I said, well, what's the ultimate expression of the occult elite? And well, it's Nazi Germany. That's really what it is. So I said, I'll start with Nazi Germany. I'll find out, is it really true that the Nazis were all tied up in the occult? And to my amazement, they were nothing else but the occult. They were tied up with all these things like the Thule Society and Ariosophy and Arminism and all these occult ideas that blossomed in Germany at the end of the Victorian era. And that's what they were. They were nothing else. Everything on top of that, from the bureaucracy to the militarization to the actual imperialism of the Third Reich, was based on these original occult ideas. And then I said, well, was it only Germany? And sure enough, I was wrong. It was everywhere. It was Soviet Union, it was America under the bushes, and the Skull and Bone Society 322. Yeah, I actually debunked myself in the end, and I have to admit that yes, our leaders are, you know, occultic psychopaths. That's the end of it.
Yeah, I mean, if you were to say this like 20 years ago, that our leaders are satanic worshipping paedophile murderers. And you look at David Cameron, you think, oh, no, really? But then you look at the Bullingdon Club. Are you aware of the Bullingdon Club?
I've heard the name. Tell me about it.
All right, this is an interesting thing. This is something I got off the Able Danger guy, David Hawkins, right? And the Bullingdon Club is the same as the Skull and Bone Society, but the Bullingdon Club is the Oxford one, which was probably the original one. And they all have this, they wear this archaic form of dress, and you can see a photograph of Nat Rothschild, David Cameron, and, I can never remember his name. Boris Johnson, yeah.
Oh, is this when they're all kids?
Yeah, that when they were at Eton together.
There's a creepy photograph. Yeah,
and this photograph of them wearing this kind of black and white, really almost medieval looking or really weird looking suit kind of thing.
Yeah, like a medieval waiter.
That's right. Anyway, so this is the Bullingdon Club, right? Now, apparently, the Bullingdon Club has an oath-taking ceremony. And the beginning of it is that when you are first inducted, everybody from the club comes into your room and destroys everything you have. That's the first thing. And this is documented, you know. And there was a film made on Channel 4 called When Boris Met Dave, and you can watch this. And it doesn't really touch into it much, but it's about the Bullingdon Club. The second one is that you, and this is the most interesting scenario. So I'll lay out the details, and then I'll talk a little bit about what it did, right? Because this is fascinating, and it's anyway. So the ceremony is that you go for a meal, and they call themselves a dining club. They go for a meal, and at some point in the meal, somebody starts a fight, and that the entire restaurant has to be destroyed, right? And then whoever's being initiated goes up to the restaurateur and simply throws money at them, literally throws money, you know, thousands and thousands of pounds, plenty enough, you know, enough for a good time and to fix up the restaurant. And they all leave and go along their merry way. And of course Boris Johnson gets kind of, there's some controversy, you know, about what he did during that thing, but this is what Dave did. And this, but the interesting thing is that before they do this, they set it up, is that they take out an insurance policy on the restaurant itself. And so they've managed to leverage themselves so that they get more than enough by getting the payout of the insurance payout. And that's how they do things like 9/11, and it's gone all the way back to the Titanic. And that's the nature of the false flag operation. Do you see that?
Wow. Yeah, that's deep.
That's deep. It's subtle, but yeah. it's a model, and it's a modus operandi. So whenever you see like a big thing get destroyed, there's an insurance policy on that. And the insurance policy is paid out, the premiums are paid out by pension funds. And so the billions of money, this is how pension funds make money. They get put against these gambles, and generally the gambles don't happen and people get their insured and pay off and nothing really big happens. But say you insure two World Trade Centers to be destroyed, you know, if they were being suddenly destroyed by a terrorist accident or a terrorist thing, and that they were to fall to a height of one story. And now that's really, really unlikely, yeah? Because if a tower block falls down, it's going to be like at least 10 stories worth, especially the World Trade Centers. So it was a really, like, an impossible thing for this thing to be triggered. Yeah. And yet, by the use of technologies, you know, people are coming out. They use a beam weapon to basically vaporize the inside of the block. They use a nuclear weapon to make a big hole underneath, and they implode the thing down into itself. And so the thing, the insurance policy, gets triggered, and the billions of dollars that were in the fireman pension fund. All goes to Larry Silverstein.
A good old-fashioned gangster protection racket.
Absolutely. And it's gone all the way back to the Chicago Fire Service, which if you weren't a member of, they would let your fire, they would even set fire to your building. Oh, you weren't insured, sorry, we couldn't put you out. Stuff happens like that, doesn't it?
Incredible.
So we see all these scams, you know, you're looking at our, you know, the palette of psychopath scams, and there aren't many, but they're creative in the way they apply them to us, because we don't see it coming. We never see it coming.
Oh, they're very devious. Very, very devious.
So he's saying, this is Dave saying here, are we saying here that the satanic stuff is actually a method of staying in control? We're essentially talking about the fabric of society. Yes, society is held together by satanic ritual. Would you agree, Thomas?
In a sense, I would. If the term satanic, it, to me, is kind of it's just a metaphor. It just basically means, you know, you use the word satanic, it has connotations regarding the Bible and Satan and all this stuff. But it goes, to me personally, that's just a good term to describe these creatures that have absolutely no decency in them. And everything is just business. They're cold.
There's no heart to it.
Yeah, no matter what background they come from, they're cold. It's just business.
Interesting. Just calm down in the chat room. Just calm down.
What's happening in the chat room?
Well, there's a fellow in there who's he knows how to run an IRC server and mess about. So look, just if everybody can just behave, I appreciate his questions or her questions. I don't know who they are. I'm very happy to take questions from him. He is taking interest. He's not being off topic. So please leave him alone.
Not fair enough.
Yeah. With that, I'm sorry, Thomas. That wasn't addressed to you at all. That was to the thing. So anyway, that's fine. Okay. So yeah, fabric of society. It's whatever it does. At the end of it, children are suffering.
Well, we all are.
And we all are, because we're all
children. We were all children at one time, weren't we?
That's right.
And childhood is extremely traumatic, no matter what. And so, yeah, it's true. At the end of it, we're all suffering. We're nothing more than cogs in a machine. We're nothing to them. We have to remember that. I always tell people, you know, the elections, the European elections are coming up. Who should I vote for? And I'm like, don't vote for any of them. They don't care about you. Like, what do you mean don't care about me? They do not care about you. The political system is not about you. You're nothing. You're nothing to them. And it's very difficult for people to understand that, because they've been raised from the time they were kids saying, oh, you must vote, or you must, you know, your great-grandparents, they fought for the right to vote. You have to vote, and you have to vote, and you have to do all this kind of thing. And it's very difficult to tell people that the political system is not about you. The government doesn't care about you. The politicians don't care about you. It's all about corporations. It's all about streamlining business. You know, that's all it's about, but nothing else. And your vote is really like going down to, you know, when you work for a big corporation and it, you know, you have these tokenistic sort of like human resource departments who fill you full of shit and bullshit about, like, you know, your part in this company is this, that, and the other. Well, that's all your governments are. They're the human resource department for the corporation that you live in, whatever that nation is called. And they give you this bullshit that, like, oh, every 4 years you can take part in this, like, you know, this version of X Factor where you can clap for your favorite politician to represent you. But nothing ever changes. It's the same crap. It's very, very difficult to explain it to the average person, because they've been so hammered with this idea that you must vote for your political party, get who you want. It's, you know, here we are tonight talking about Jimmy Savile and Cyril Smith and satanic child abuse. That's, you know, before we even get to that, to discuss with the average person the fact that the electrical system means nothing, the electoral system means nothing, is difficult enough for the average person to deal with. That's what shows you how these bastards have had society sewn up, that they have, they create these mirages, and this mirage is democracy, this mirage is the media, this mirage is television, this mirage is law and order, and 90% of society believes it without question. That's how devious they are.
So, we have more questions. Does Mr. Sheridan have knowledge about the Falklands War, the Thule Society, or the Thule Society, and the connection to the Black Goo? Oh, the Black Goo, That's a great story.
I do, actually. I was told by somebody, off record, that the Falklands War was really about... what happened was, down in the late 70s in the Falklands Islands and in the South Atlantic, there was some oil drilling went on. This is the legend, and it's an amazing story, that anyway, a kind of an oil was actually released during these drilling. And what they found, that the oil was actually alive. It was a creature. It had like consciousness. It was actually a living being, like an animal. The oil. This is what the cover story was for the Falklands War. The Argentinians had discovered this accidentally. The Falklands War was about this cover story for the fact that the Argentinians had discovered this oil that was actually alive. And the Chileans had it too as well in Tierra del Fuego. And what happened was, this is how serious it was, during the Falklands War, at one point, the Argentinians were winning. They sunk a couple of battleships with the Exocet missiles. HMS Sheffield was one of them. Margaret Thatcher demanded from the French Prime Minister, François Mitterrand, that if you do not give us the locking codes for the Exocet missile, we will drop a nuclear weapon on top of Argentina's second largest city. And Mitterrand gave Thatcher the locking codes for the Exocet missile. And that's how the UK, Britain, whatever, won the Falklands War. Now, people forget how savage that war was. That was a very short war on a very small island. And it was something like 2,000 casualties. That's very, very, very high for, you know, that kind of conflict. That's huge numbers. By modern warfare standards. They had secured the island, and there's a total lockdown there now on those islands. Now, what's interesting, as part of the deal of this, the French were allowed this insight, this is the theory now, into this living oil, this living creature. And apparently the French are now the experts on this stuff. Now, when the Deep Well Horizon rig in the Gulf of Mexico back in 2009 fell over after drilling sideways into a shaft, it was actually a French submarine that was first on the actual rig. Again, they had found this oil. Now, I don't know if this is true or not. This is the story. But I heard this from someone who was actually an oil insider person. Again, they found the same oil that was discovered in the Falklands. It was an oil that actually had a reaction, like it was a, if you touched it, it would run away. It would chase after boats. It would, if you shot at it, it would actually jump as if it was hurt. This oil was alive. I don't know if this is true or not, but this is, the whole Falklands War was a cover story by Thatcher and Reagan to shut down this thing, that a living creature was found in oil. That's what I know about it.
Interesting. Well, I saw a Bases interview. Do you know Miles Johnson?
I know the name, but I don't know.
All right. He's done an amazing series of interviews of really interesting people, and some of them shortly before they died. One of them was about this oil that, which is essentially, it's nanobots. But it's a sort of biological thing, and they were working on it at something like, I don't know if it was Porton Down or one of those, you know, germ lab places. And the experiment didn't work, and they poured it down the toilet. Really, really smart. They poured this stuff down the toilet, and it sort of bred, and it's got a mind of its own and stuff. And then what happens is it floats up in vapor, and it affects people who get vapors from the sewers. Very interesting stuff. I can't remember which one it was. I think it was about number 23 or number 24, Miles Johnson's Bases series. He's interviewed all sorts of like super soldiers and people involved in weird programs.
Well, it's not a huge stretch when you look at that Corexit stuff that they were throwing in the Gulf. Again, it was a living organism that they were throwing in. It was a genetically modified organism they were throwing in on the Gulf oil after the Deepwater Horizon thing in 2009. Again, what are they up to with oil? Why, you know, we have to start, look, this is the thing of my new work with like the whole thing of Al Porges now. We have to start going back and looking at everything and asking for what they did. What do they really mean? Why are they obsessed with gold? What is it about gold that obsessed them? Again, oil. Is it more than just the fuel? Do they have a kind of a relationship with oil that is almost like religious? Why is the United States willing to nearly destroy itself to obtain the oil of the Middle East? Is oil a kind of beyond a fossil fuel, beyond a form of energy? Is it that these lunatics in charge, these occult psychopaths, is oil some kind of sacrament? Do they know something about oil that we don't? We have to go back and assume that everything is up for question.
That is for sure. Everything that we've been told is a lie.
Big time.
It's something I've been talking to my son about, you know, all these years. He's growing up now. He's 18 now. It's very interesting because his mother is very, establishmentarian.
Conservative.
Yeah, very conservative. Yeah. She used to be a hippie until she had the child. And anyway, long story. So he's got this other side. He's like, you know, really wanting to find out the truth of stuff. So it'd be an interesting expression because he's going to be making movies. He's already started making movies and photographing things. So it'll be interesting to see how he expresses all that. But it is part of an exposure of the truth of the trauma that these classes go through. But it all comes down to the trauma of the sort of central core of the establishment, which you've kind of identified just going through my list of P words, psychopaths. But you know, everybody's got a P word for the same people. These people are, as you say, they're puzzling people. We don't understand them because they're not like us.
No, they're completely different. We have to, this is the whole issue again. We have to understand that these people who run the world, not all of them, but the ones who are not psychopaths, unfortunately become infected by them, whatever this infection of consciousness is. And we have to realize that you cannot debate reason or meet them halfway because it's a completely different form of consciousness.
Reason is, there's no persuasion through emotional. You can't say, you know, they can't do, you can't do to them what they do to us, which is persuade them, persuade through an emotional plea.
You can't even make them understand it. You could, like, say, you know, you cannot torture these people here. They're human beings, they're families. And their families, you know, if you kill them, their families will be heartbroken. They'll miss them. They can't even get that. They'd be like, what are you on about? They're nobodies. They're like used cheeseburger cartons. This is literally what we're dealing with. It's a different form of humanity that sees the rest of us as units, as human resources, as, you know, waste products to be used and then discarded. So when they reduce humanity as a whole, you know, apart from themselves, to this level, what you're dealing with are people who don't, that can kill without, you know, it's like the whole Joseph Stalin thing. One death is a tragedy, a million deaths are a statistic. That's a psychopathic mind.
So, Thomas, fascinating conversation. I'd like to thank you for walking down these dark corridors, accompanying me with humor and with courage. You know, I think we may have uncovered, you know, torn back a little bit more of that canvas cover that is covering over society. And I believe that, you know, this is the time of the uncovering, the revealing. You know, whatever you call it, you know, some people call it the apocalypse, but that's the same word. It just means the revealing. So, yeah, we're here. Everybody, be nice to each other, love each other. Thomas, how do you get to? How do people get to buy your book? Do you have any readings? Do you do it over audiobook as well? Have you done all that?
No, I don't do things like that. Firstly, I apologise. I'm very tired tonight. I've been working all day long, so if I haven't been too bouncy, that's the reason why. Yes, they can. They can check my website, thomassheridanart.com, and the links there to the books are there. And they can check them from that point on. And if they're interested in buying them, they can. I haven't done the audiobook thing yet. Those kind of things take an awful lot of work, and I'm kind of a small operation. I don't have that kind of backing of a big publishing house or anything like that. But they're definitely something that I would like to do at some point. In fact, I'd like to even go further and actually like make a book that is never produced in print, but it's just the spoken word, you know, like an oral tradition thing. That's something that really fascinates me at some point in the future. But thomassheridanart.com is where they can check out my work. And thanks again. It was a great conversation tonight. And again, it's a shame it's so late. I'd love to come back on again and continue this conversation if you'd have me.
Awesome. Listen, Thomas, you know, let's just make it like, you know, you come over a few months and we talk about what you're doing, because we're all on parallel paths and we're all studying a different aspect of the great hologram that is about to fall and make sure that we're out of the way as it collapses, hopefully in slow motion. Thomas Sheridan, it's been marvelous having you on, and stay tuned, everybody, it's going to come up with Frank Jordan and the Earthmind Think Tank Group, and bring out your dead, bring out your injured, if you've got any healing. Thomas, did you say you were suffering a bit this year?
Yeah, I've had a few health problems. And I get tired very easily, and I get I've had problems with my kidneys from, it's an infection kind of thing, and I'm getting better now, but I don't have the energy I had like a year or two ago. I'm getting better, but it's like I get tired very, very easily, and so, like, you know, I'm glad to be here tonight, but that's what I was just saying. If I wasn't my usual kind of like melty self, it's just because I'm so tired.
Everybody's saying, oh, please have Thomas back, great show. You're talking about the kidneys. We'll be talking about kidneys. We'll bring it up because I know at least three people, including the guy who runs this station, who have got kidney issues. So
that is very interesting.
And a lot of it is to do, you know, for, when people come to me and they're saying, you know, kidney issues, it's about rage that has been held back.
And there you go.
It's crystallized and it makes blockages and it stops the water coming in. Anyway, long story. God bless you, Thomas. We'll include you in our healing circle if that is your wish.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you, JP.
Great. And everybody's saying, oh, yes, bring Thomas back. Everybody, thank you very much. This has been Ever Beyond. Beyond.